Some of the scenes you will witness may appear to border on fantasy.
I can game it in a big way.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
Yes, yes. But
I mean, tonight
we care, and it shows.
The law.
Of course. You will listen and obey.
The country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary or whether he did not cooperate made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
And senator strokes and Cuban mobs and Afghan opium and Saudi ambassadors and angry Oregon senators and toxic dust and a whole lot more. You can go to mediamonarchy.blogspot.com for all the news and views and videos we're going to cover today. We got a lot to go through. We're going to kick it off right. We're going to listen to the Fugs. Kill for Peace.
Blood.
from Promise Scream when the bomb drops. My name's James. You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. It's Friday, December 15th. A lot of news, even in the headlines right now, is a rough night in the Pacific Northwest. 3 dead and a million without power. New Mexico's governor is going to meet with North Korean officials. 2 ATF agents were shot in Atlanta last night, and 2 more Marines killed in Baghdad. So that's what we got starting today. And the top story on Media Monarchy right now is a reminder about this radio show and also a link to the podcasts of the previous 5 episodes. And those are posted up thanks to RadioForAll.net. Our first news story, though, is a funny one. Like Bill Hicks would say, you know, it's irony on a base level, but it's a hoot. Border fence firm hires illegal workers. This is coming from NPR. A fence-building company in Southern California agrees to pay nearly $5 million in fines for hiring illegal immigrants. 2 executives from the company may also serve jail time. The Golden State Fence Company's work includes some of the border fence between San Diego and Mexico.
A California construction company and 2 of its executives have pleaded guilty to knowingly hiring illegal immigrants. They've agreed to forfeit $5 million. Golden State Fence Company has built millions of dollars worth of fencing around homes, offices, and military bases. The company even built a section of fence along the U.S.-Mexico border. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Federal prosecutors say when it comes to hiring illegal immigrants, the Golden State Fence Company knew no boundaries. After an immigration check in 1999 found undocumented workers on its payroll, Golden State promised to clean house. But when follow-up checks were made in 2004 and 2005, some of those same illegal workers were still on the job. In fact, U.S. Attorney Carol Lamb says as many as a third of the company's 750 workers may have been in the country illegally.
This case illustrates the flagrant abuse of our immigration laws by some corporate employers who encourage illegal immigration by offering jobs to those they know do not have permission to work in the United States.
As part of its guilty plea, Golden State agreed to forfeit $4.7 million, and its president and one of its Southern California managers will pay fines totaling $300,000. The government is also recommending jail time for Melvin Kay and Michael McLaughlin, probably about 6 months.
This was an egregious case, and we felt that jail time was appropriate. Certainly, other companies should take note that the government did insist on jail time in this case for the principals of the company.
In fact, it's exceptionally rare for those who employ illegal immigrants to face any kind of criminal prosecution, let alone jail time. Earlier this week, for example, immigration raids on 6 meatpacking plants netted almost 1,300 suspected illegal workers. But no charges were leveled against the company that runs the plants, Swift. Golden State Fence's attorney, Richard Hirsch, admits his client broke the law, but he says that's why construction companies need a guest worker program.
I'll tell you something. The work that this company performs requires people to stand in hot sun, sometimes 100 degrees or more, digging holes in the deserts, and it's tough to get people to do that kind of work.
Golden State is now part of a pilot program with the federal government that allows employers to verify workers' employment documents online. Golden State says for the last year, all of its employees have been subjected to the screening. Hirsch challenged competitors to do the same. Scott Horsley, NPR News, San Diego.
Thanks, NPR. Jumping on to our next story, second Colorado evangelical resigns over gay sex. Coming from Reuters, a second Colorado evangelical leader in little over a month has resigned from the pulpit over a scandal involving gay sex, church officials said on Tuesday. Paul Barnes has resigned from the 2,100-member Grace Chapel, a church he founded in suburban Denver, said church spokeswoman Michelle Ames. Barnes' resignation follows last month's admission by high-profile preacher Ted Haggart that he was guilty of unspecified sexual immorality after a male prostitute went public with their liaisons. Many evangelical Christians view homosexuality as a sin, though some are more strident on the issue than others. I've got a link on that story to the Grace Chapel webpage and their job openings. And there's nothing listed yet, but I'll keep my eye peeled for you. Texas bill would give blind the right to vote. And this is coming from the Times Online. The blind will be able to go hunting if a Texas bill becomes law. They would have to be accompanied by a sighted hunter who would help guide their shots and carry proof that they were legally blind.
The law will also allow them to use a laser sight, a device forbidden to sighted hunters. Edmund Kumpel, state representative who introduced the bill, said, "This opens up the fun of hunting to additional people, and I think that's great." The Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, which regulates hunting, has no definition for what constitutes a legally blind hunter. The bill would give it until January 1, 2008 to come up with a definition. Texas enjoys a reputation for outdoor sports and is where Dick Cheney, the U.S. vice president, accidentally shot a friend in the face while hunting for quail this year. So now that we got all those great ironic stories out of the way, we'll jump on to a little more serious stuff. Gates unlikely to rein in Pentagon on intelligence, coming from Reuters. Robert Gates is unlikely to rein in the Pentagon's controversial post-9/11 expansion into intelligence, despite concerns the U.S. military is ill-suited for espionage outside the battlefield, experts say. But Gates, the former CIA director who will be sworn in as defense secretary on Monday, could help heal a rift between the Pentagon and civilian intelligence agencies caused by the confrontational tactics of his predecessor, Donald Rumsfeld. "You're going to have a real change in tone at the top, and the watchword will be practicality," said Robert Grenier, former director of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. Well known for his zeal and cooperation, Gates will make good on a public pledge to support U.S. Intelligence Chief John Negroponte, whose 20-month-old office oversees 16 intelligence agencies, including several that are operated by the Defense Department. "I anticipate generally smooth relations between military and civilian intelligence with Gates as Secretary of Defense," said former CIA Acting Director John McLaughlin. "Since the Reagan administration, we've been at war a lot," says Richard Kerr, a Deputy Director of Central Intelligence under Gates. "The nature of the requirements for defense has changed quite a bit. Quite realistically, they want to satisfy their own requirements." Alleged liquid bomb plot credibility crumbles. The court clears Roth of charges as much-vaunted transatlantic airliner attack dissipates into another staged terror alert. This is coming from Propaganda Matrix. The alleged ringleader of a much-vaunted plot to blow up multiple transatlantic airliners using liquid explosives has been cleared of terrorism charges and of being a member of any terrorist group, rendering August's terror scare another hyped creation of government scaremongering. "In every single major terror bust or terror alert, we have proven the evidence to be flawed and the charges to be cooked-up nonsense aimed at prolonging the illusion that terror cells are lurking around every corner waiting to cause mayhem. The geopolitical agenda the U.S., Britain, and Israel depends on the proliferation of phony terror threats in order to continue the farcical war on terror and take more of our innate freedoms at home to stifle dissent against the plot for worldwide hegemony." The supposed transatlantic bomb plot has dissipated into another staged terror alert. And here we've got the BBC report that says, "A Pakistani judge has ruled there is not enough evidence to try a key suspect in an alleged airline bomb plot on terrorism charges. He has moved the case of Rashid Rauf of Britain from an anti-terrorism court to a regular court where he faces lesser charges such as forgery. The Pakistani authorities described him as a key figure, but an anti-terrorism court in Rawalpindi found no evidence that he had been involved in any terrorist activities or that he belonged to a terrorist organization. Since the panic surrounding the ridiculous hoax that led to an outright ban on all liquids in U.S. and British airports, the credibility of the alleged plot itself has crumbled. In a series of reports following the August 10th scare, we traced the source of the alleged attack plot to Pakistani and British intelligence and were rapidly able to confirm that the story was nothing more than a manufactured ploy to frighten travelers at the height of the holiday season. Comes as no surprise that the Pakistanis have acquitted Rashid Rauf. His involvement with the Lashkar-e-Toiba group provides a direct lineage back to the Pakistani ISI, which is in turn controlled by the CIA and British intelligence. Rauf likely acted as a willing patsy for the plot to be pinned on, while Blair government waved it in front of the Britons as another reason for them to accept the Blair Strip 1 fascist surveillance state without dissent. It was revealed that the alleged terrorist cell that planned to blow up 10 planes had been completely infiltrated for weeks before the announcement of the foiled plot by British intelligence. From the evidence at hand, allied with past history of how MI5 work, which was presented in this previous article, you can link to it, it can be reasonably claimed that an MI5 mole within the group orchestrated the entire operation. According to news reports, the British government and MI5 wanted to wait at least a week before busting the liquid terror cell that their agents had fully infiltrated, including planting a mole within the bomb squad. From the acknowledged timeline and admission that the real attack was scheduled for August 16th, little else can be deduced but the shocking fact that MI5 wanted the bombings to go forward, arresting the perpetrators only after the attack. Echoing the activities of the 7-7 bomber, some of the main suspects in the case, aside from Rashid Rauf, exhibited behavior that in no way suggested they were preparing to launch a mid-air suicide attack on jumbo jets. Far from preparing his last will and testament, psyching himself up for his imminent death, or acquiring the necessary materials to conduct the operation, Taib Rauf was caught on CCTV hours before the launch of the plot doing something far more mundane. He was buying cake for his father's confectionery business. Former British ambassador to Uzbekistan Craig Murray slammed the so-called foiled plot story as, quote, propaganda. Propaganda on behalf of Bush and Blair, who both yearn for a new 9/11 to reinvigorate their flagging support base. None of the alleged terrorists had made a bomb. None had bought a plane ticket. Many did not even have passports, which, given the efficiency of the UK passport agency, would mean they wouldn't be on a plane for quite some time, said Murray. Unconfirmed sources suggest that inside speculators with informants inside the British intelligence apparatus took advantage of their foreknowledge of the announcement of the foiled terror plot to place put options on airline stocks, reaping the benefits of their subsequent fall. Airline stocks dropped as much as 28% during morning trading following the announcement of the alleged liquid bomb plot. You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. My name's James. You can go to mediamonarchy.blogspot.com or praradio.com. And I've got podcasts of the previous five episodes posted up on radioforall.net. Now, as previously promised, mistakenly, this time let's listen to the Fugs' Kill for Peace. On the Portland Radio Authority. My name's James, your host. Our next story, Senator Stroke could halt Democratic takeover. Coming from the AP. On Wednesday, Democratic Senator Tim Johnson of South Dakota suffered a possible stroke Wednesday and was taken to a Washington hospital, his office said. If he should be unable to continue to serve, it could halt the scheduled Democratic takeover of the Senate. Democrats won a 51-49 majority in the November election. South Dakota's governor, who would appoint any temporary replacements, is a Republican. I think the latest news as of this morning is he's been through surgery and he's in stable but at a critical condition. Cuban mob attacks human rights protesters, coming from the Washington Post. More than 200 Cuban government supporters attacked 15 human rights activists on International Human Rights Day on Sunday, manhandling the demonstrators as they drove them from a Havana park. 10 Canadians die after taking bird flu vaccine. This is coming from World Poultry. Following reports that patients taking Tamiflu can exhibit dangerous behavior, news has surfaced that 10 Canadians have died and at least 74 have adverse reactions after taking the flu drug. Health Canada has been criticized for not issuing an update about the drug sooner. Judge strikes down part of a Bush anti-terror order, coming again from the Washington Post. A federal judge in Los Angeles who previously struck down sections of the Patriot Act has ruled that provisions of an anti-terror order issued by President George W. Bush after 9/11 are unconstitutional. Jumping around the world, military takes hard line in the face of dissent. Fiji's military rulers are cracking down on dissent, making house calls on those who dare criticize the new regime. Only a night after their illegal takeover last Tuesday, the army was flexing its muscles well before yesterday's declaration it would interrogate anyone suspected of inciting opposition to the new regime. FBI taps cell phone mic as eavesdropping tool, coming from CNET News. The FBI appears to have begun using a novel form of electronic surveillance in criminal investigations, remotely activating a mobile phone's microphone and using it to eavesdrop on nearby conversations. The technique is called a roving bug. There's a link there. You can read a lot more about roving bugs, if you recall, on episode 5. We played a bit from the BBC documentary called Suspect Nation. And in that documentary, the investigator is being tracked all through his investigations, and at the end it shows how the hacker and tracker tracked Porter everywhere he went, and at one point tapped into his cell phone while it was just sitting there and recorded their entire conversation. Military radio signal jams garage doors. This is coming from the AP. What do remote control garage door openers have to do with national security? A secretive Air Force facility in Colorado Springs tested a radio frequency this past week that it would use to communicate with first responders in the event of a homeland security threat. But the frequency also controls an estimated 50 million garage door openers, and hundreds of residents in the area found that theirs had suddenly stopped working. Look who owns U.S. debt now. Other nations hold a record 52% of U.S. debt, leaving the U.S. economy vulnerable. Coming from the USA Today, for most of U.S. history, the national debt was something that America owed itself. What was borrowed by the government was lent by its people. The liabilities of one were the assets of the other, but that has changed as the federal government has increasingly looked abroad to finance its prodigious borrowing. Foreigners now hold a record 52% of the government's $4 trillion in outside debt, up a quarter from 1995. Crime, corruption inside Homeland Security, coming from Homeland Stupidity. Buried in what would otherwise have been a dry summary of financial audits and inspections, the Department of Homeland Security Inspector General's semi-annual report to Congress, and you can get the PDF off of Media Monarchy, also contains dozens of reports of misconduct and criminal activity perpetrated by the Department of Homeland Security employees themselves.
He was a CIA case officer in the field, helped found the founder of the modern Marine Corps intelligence, and he is an author, lecturer, reviews books for Amazon, and he is a big speaker at the large hacking conferences and technology conferences. He is, of course, Robert David Steele, the website OSS.net, links to it up on Infowars.com. But in the last few minutes we've got with you, last time it made big headlines. Literally dozens of major technology publications, headlines, former CIA agent, expert on these systems, comes out and says that Google's in bed with the CIA. Now, of course, we know other organizations and groups are as well. Can you elaborate on that or comment on that? And then,
The addendum, I don't know if you're aware of this, but I'm sure you are. Google has come out and said they're going to use the microphones and cameras that are on most computers to have passive, quote, passive systems record your words to put into a psychological algorithm for marketing. Of course, then there's the dual intelligence gathering capability of that for the government. Can you comment on what Google's doing, or elaborate any on why Google is in bed with the CIA?
Well, I'll try and do this very concisely. I'm also concerned about the fact that the FBI is now turning cell phones on. Unless you remove the battery from your cell phone, it can now be activated by the FBI, and they can listen to whatever your cell phone can hear.
Now, they've been doing that since 96.
Well, it's a very, very disturbing trend. First off, I think Google took money from the CIA when it was poor and it was starting up. And unfortunately, our system right now floods money into spying and other illegal and largely unethical activities, and it doesn't fund what I call the open source world, which is both intelligence and software. I'm working to change that. In fact, I'm starting a new nonprofit.
I mean, just how in bed is Google with the CIA?
Right now, I would say it's a small but significant relationship. It is by no means dominating Google. In fact, Google has been embarrassed because everything that CIA asked it to do, they couldn't do. So Google is kind of off there. However, I think it's also very, very wrong of Google to have this relationship.
Well, what do you think about them censoring videos and erasing my hit counts and things?
Well, I think they're not only censoring videos, they're censoring press releases. I think that I've seen some press releases that are very critical of Dick Cheney and others that somehow don't make it to Google News, even though they're released by PR Newswire.
Exactly, which is a normal affiliate. I've been an affiliate of Google News, but they selectively do not add most of what I put in, and then months later, suddenly hundreds of our stories then show up.
Well, I think that you have to recognize, I mean, I always say when choosing between incompetence and conspiracy, go with incompetence every time. I think Google has gotten way too big for itself. Google Answers just self-destructed because Google wouldn't listen to all of us that were trying to help it. I think Google is long overdue for a public audit. And one of the problems with privatized power is that it's not subject to public audit. I believe that there is a marketplace for a handheld and a laptop that allows the end user to completely control all outgoing emissions. And I believe there's a desperate need for a citizen activist skunk works that can thoroughly scrub stuff. And I absolutely believe that we should put Google out of business unless they're willing to go the open source software route.
So do you think all that coverage your interview got concerning their involvement with the CIA, do you think that concerned them?
It concerned them enough to lie to the public. They denied it.
But you have sources in the CIA that are involved.
Let me say very explicitly, their contact at CIA is named Dr. Rick Steinheiser. He's in the Office of Research and Development.
And you've got evidence that they took money, seed money, at Google.
I don't have the receipts, Alex. I just know this from trusted individuals.
So you have sources saying they're at the inception or shortly
they've
after?
They've been together for quite a while.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Steele.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Take care. Bye-bye.
God bless. We'll talk to you again soon. Stay with us.
We have a new problem. We have a new problem.
Weirdos with We Got the Neutron Bomb. You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. My name's James. You can go to mediamonarchy.blogspot.com for all the news we cover on these shows. You can also get podcasts now of the previous episodes, thanks to radioforall.net. Jumping on to our next story, another great article from Jerry Mazza. Afghanistan's opium crop at all-time high. And the question is, why? Under Taliban rule, which began in the late 1990s, Afghanistan just about kicked the growing habit by 2001. After 5 years, the Taliban is slipping back in, but poppy production has grown by leaps and bounds. According to the Washington Post, opium production in Afghanistan, which provides more than 90% of the world's heroin, broke all records in 2006, reaching a historic high despite ongoing U.S.-sponsored eradication efforts, the Bush administration reported yesterday. In addition to a 26% production increase over the past year for a total of 5,644 metric tons, the amount of land under cultivation in opium poppies grew by 61%. Cultivation in the two main production provinces, Helmand in the southwest and Uruzgan in central Afghanistan, was up by 132%. With a flair for understatement, White House Drug Policy Chief John Walters called the news disappointing. I'd say it was shocking, but curiously, the resurgent Taliban forces were cited as the main impediment to stabilization and reconstruction efforts in Afghanistan, and the U.S. military investment has far exceeded anti-narcotic and deployment programs. But Walters went so far as to say the drug trade as a problem rivals and in some ways exceeds the Taliban, threatening to derail other aspects of U.S. policy. But I thought when those bearded brigands, the Taliban, were there, poppy production was near nil, 94% gone. Somehow this brings to mind a Michael Rupert article, The Bush-Cheney Drug Empire, published in Nexus Magazine, and there's a link to it right here on Media Monarchy. He wrote that the Bush family's involvement in drug running is an open secret, that Dick Cheney's direct link to a global drug pipeline through a U.S. construction company is less well known. And that story is fairly long and in-depth. I just gave you the nitty-gritty. Next on Media Monarchy, Saudi ambassador abruptly resigns and leaves Washington. Again from the Washington Post, Prince Turki Al-Faisal, Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the United States, flew out of Washington yesterday, meaning Monday, after informing Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and his staff that he would be leaving the post after only 15 months on the job, according to U.S. officials and foreign envoys. There's been no formal announcement from the kingdom. The abrupt departure is particularly striking because his predecessor, Prince Bandar bin Sultan, spent 22 years on the job. The Saudi ambassador is one of the most influential diplomatic positions in Washington and is arguably the most important overseas post for the oil-rich desert kingdom. Turki, a long-serving former intelligence chief, told his staff yesterday afternoon that he wanted to spend more time with his family, according to Arab diplomats. Colleagues said they were shocked at the decision. Our next story is a good one, and this made a lot of headlines here in the Pacific Northwest. Senator Gordon Smith said he can't be quiet anymore. He made an amazing speech and then actually went on CNN to elaborate, and we're going to listen to Senator Gordon Smith and old Wolfie on the Situation Room.
As the Iraq war has worsened, some senators who voted for the war have now come out against it. One of them is the now very frustrated senator who's calling for a very, very serious course correction and is actually blasting the Bush administration. That senator being Republican Gordon Smith of Oregon. He had this to say late last week about Iraq. Listen to this.
I, for one, am at the end of my rope when it comes to supporting a policy that has our soldiers patrolling the same streets in the same way, being blown up by the same bombs day after day. That is absurd. It may even be criminal. I cannot support that anymore.
So if the U.S. Policy were in fact criminal, who might be held accountable? And joining us now, Republican Senator Gordon Smith of Oregon. Senator, a powerful emotional statement. I know, coming from your gut, coming from your heart. Why the about face?
Well, Wolf, if you have the privilege of representing one of the United States and you have a voice and a vote, now's the time to speak up. And I felt duty-bound to say what was on my heart and to describe how this war had mutated from one thing to another, from taking out a tyrant and a terrorist and ridding him of weapons of mass destruction and establishing democracy, to now being street cops in a sectarian civil war. That's not what I voted for. That is not what the American people are for.
So you concluded this is now a civil war in Iraq.
I have concluded that. This is a fight, when you get right down to the root of it, between Sunnis and Shias, that goes back a millennia of time, over who is the rightful successor to the Prophet Muhammad. That is not our fault. That is not our fight. And that's not something we can fix.
Was there one issue, one thing that happened that pushed you over to deliver this remarkable address on the Senate floor?
Well, I've read a number of books recently that got me thinking and stirred up. And then I woke up Wednesday, I believe it was, to the news that 10 more of our fighting men and maybe a woman, I don't know, but they were killed again in another roadside bomb. And I just simply hit the end of the rope, if you will. And I felt I had to speak up, because if these sacrifices are being made in pursuit of a policy that cannot succeed, then we need to admit it and readjust in a way that the American people and our soldiers find worth the sacrifice. And this is not.
You used the word criminal in that statement, a very sharp, pointed word. If, in fact, some of the actions committed by the U.S. were criminal, who should be held accountable?
Well, if you'll read my remarks in context, I was clearly speaking rhetorically, not in a legal sense. But I find examples like when the British generals, day after day in the First World War, would send thousands of their men in, running into machine guns and not make adjustments. I find that criminal. And when we send our young folks out in vehicles that cannot take out these, or rather accept these kinds of blasts to them without taking their lives, I don't find that smart, and I find that very derelict in duty. Moreover, if you think we should be going out and fighting them, you have to answer the question whether the insurgency that this has become is worth doing. If you say yes, it is, then you have to adapt your tactics. What we are doing, and I have seen this with my own eyes in Iraq, what we are doing is sending them out from the green zone, clearing, and then retreating back to the green zone. Now, I got to tell you, that doesn't make any sense if you're fighting an insurgency. History will tell you, to fight and win insurgencies, you have to clear, hold, and then build. So you build confidence in the people there so that they become the foot soldiers. They root out the terrorists, and they ultimately fight for their freedom. It's not our country, it's theirs.
So let me repeat the question. Who should be held accountable for what you believe has now become, and I'll just use a word, fiasco or disaster or some word along those lines?
Well, I think all of us with positions of responsibility are accountable. But clearly, I can't be quiet anymore. I'm leveling this charge at no one man or woman, but I am clearly saying that the American people will and should hold us accountable. So if you got something to say, now's the time to say it. Either let's fight the war intelligently for an objective that is obtainable, or let's admit it and figure out how to preserve the lives of our soldiers.
Because morally speaking, if you do conclude it's futile right now and that a year from now it's not going to make any difference what the U.S. does, that the situation is still going to be a sectarian civil war, your words, is it moral to keep U.S. men and women in harm's way and let another 1,000 or so Americans die over the next year if it's going to simply wind up exactly, if not worse than it is right now?
Yeah, it is not right to do that. Let me also add, though, that we have an ongoing interest in prosecuting the war on terror, a fight from which we can retreat only at the peril of our own nation. There are ways to reposition on the borders of Iraq to take on terrorist jihadists from Iran, Syria, Saudi Arabia. And these are the people that we want to fight. That is our fight. And ultimately, that is a very important fight for our country, for our sake, not just for Iraq.
Knowing what you know now, and obviously with hindsight we're all a lot smarter, if you had to do it over again, knowing there's no WMD in Iraq, no Al-Qaeda connection, knowing 3,000 Americans were going to be killed, $400 billion spent, $2 billion a week, would you have voted for that resolution to support this war?
As I said in my floor statement, had I known there were no WMD there, I would not have voted for it. But I do want to add that I believe it's a good thing that we remove Saddam Hussein. I think there would have been other ways to do that without the cost in life and treasure that our current approach has led us to.
One final question, Senator. Do you think President Bush is, as his critics charge, still in a state of denial?
I say in sorrow, not in anger. President Bush is my friend, and I know he agonizes day and night over this issue. He has a very determined streak in him, and yet I have to believe he knows, with the Iraq study group and what others are saying, that the time is now to rethink this and reposition the American war against terrorism.
Senator Gordon Smith, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
So that's Oregon Senator Gordon Smith speaking from Portland, Oregon, to old Wolf Blitzer on CNN Situation Room. Not exactly a hardcore anti-war stance, but that's some progress, and that's made quite the bit of headlines here in the Pacific Northwest. Our next story on media monarchy is one we've covered time and time again here on even just the few amount of episodes we've done. This is coming from PBS. 60% of Ground Zero workers sick. PBS News reports 60% or more of Twin Towers Ground Zero workers are suffering from respiratory illness. And New York City and the feds are dragging their feet on getting them health care. And we're going to listen to a report from PBS. This is Jim Lehrer on the NewsHour.
Now, dust and debris at the World Trade Center site after 9/11. Did it cause disease in rescue workers? NewsHour correspondent Tom Bearden has our science unit report.
Clouds of toxic dust rolled down New York City streets like tidal waves on September 11, 2001, engulfing tens of thousands of people fleeing the collapse of the World Trade Center. In the months that followed, thousands more labored on what they called the pile, first trying to rescue people, and later recovering human remains. And all the while, they inhaled the dust. Philip Landrigan is the chairman of preventive medicine at Manhattan's Mount Sinai School of Medicine.
The major component of the World Trade Center dust was pulverized concrete, cement, which was very, very alkaline, at a pH of 10 or 11, which means that the alkalinity of this material is equivalent to that of Drano.
The dust also contained billions of microscopic shards of glass and other contaminants. The question is, what did the dust do to those who inhaled it?
You trudge through, this debris and smoke, and half of the street was sunny, the other half was a dark cloud, debris up to my thighs.
NYPD detectives John Walcott and his partner Richard Volpe spent hundreds of hours at the Trade Center.
Basically, I didn't have a shovel or anything. I just started digging with my hands and going through the rubble and picking up, twisted metal and stuff like that, just trying to find somebody.
They believe the experience is slowly killing them.
I ended up with AML leukemia, which is mainly caused by exposure to benzene, which we all know is an airline fuel.
How about you?
I was diagnosed with IgA nephropathy, which is basically the filters in my kidneys. They don't filter out the toxins in my body. Right now I'm sitting here with less than 40% function in both my kidneys.
Attorney David Warby has filed a class action lawsuit on behalf of Volpe and Walcott and nearly 9,000 more Ground Zero rescue workers. In the courtroom, he will have to prove it's the dust that caused their illnesses.
I have 80 clients who have died, some from heart attacks, from pulmonary collapse, some from leukemia, some from cancers that are carcinogenically related.
The lawsuit was filed against the City of New York and its contractors. City officials did not return calls for interview requests. Warby knows that proving all these injuries were caused by the dust will be a formidable task.
In court, you have to prove with a reasonable degree of medical certainty, based upon recognized epidemiological and toxicological studies, expert opinions, peer-reviewed rated medical studies with 95% scientific certainty upon which your experts base their decisions. So if you're dealing with a situation that no one's seen before, it's awfully tough to come up with those studies.
Take a big breath in again.
And scientific studies, particularly those relating to human health, take decades. There have been similar cases before. Agent Orange in Vietnam, industrial chemicals at Love Canal, New York, dioxin at Times Beach, Missouri.
The issue of certainty is one that we often dance around. That's the objective of science. It's the search for the truth.
Joseph Graziano is Associate Dean for Research at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University. He says it's extraordinarily hard to scientifically establish specific causes and effects.
Each of us has a different lifestyle, a different diet, a different family history, and so we end up studying sets of people who are a mix of people, and not everyone will respond to a given dose or a given dose of a mixture of chemicals in the same fashion.
He says what's needed most to make a causal connection between dust and disease is time.
It's like developing a piece of film in the dark room. You look at the film early on and you see a faint image of what the picture is. You look at cigarette smoking. It takes 20 years before cancers develop, for example. And asbestos exposure. It takes many years before the mesotheliomas develop.
But Detective Volpe says the one thing many trade center workers don't have is time.
People are dying every day. And time is everything right now. I mean, they want to sit here and they want to do all these different tests and they want to do all this research. You know, we might not have that time for the research.
Some scientists believe they have already proven a connection between trade center dust and respiratory problems. Dr. William Rahm, who is director of chest services at Bellevue Hospital, showed us microscopic images of material found in the lungs of a firefighter who came into his hospital in respiratory failure.
This is a World Trade Center dust particle. You can see that it's been burned, and it has a very rounded shape, but it's got some odd pieces to it.
Relatively speaking, how big is that?
A red blood cell is 7 microns, so this is below the size of a red blood cell. So that means that this can be inhaled into the nose and into the trachea and way out to the periphery of the lung to the air sacs.
Rahm also found a burned piece of fiberglass and this asbestos fiber.
And this is very long and very narrow. So this kind of fiber can get into the lung by coming lengthwise with the end or radius leading the way.
Dr. Rahm says an awful lot of people inhaled these materials.
Over 11,000 firefighters responded to the initial collapse and were exposed to the most intense dust clouds over those days. And over 1,800 of these firefighters have been retired on a respiratory disability.
And that is, are you satisfied that's a direct result of working in that area?
We are convinced that this is a direct result from the dust exposure to the World Trade Center dust.
And in September, Mount Sinai released a significant study that monitored roughly 9,200 recovery workers, showing similar connections.
The major finding that we reported was that approximately
60% of these people had developed new respiratory symptoms since starting work at Ground Zero.
Normal breath in.
While scientists seem to agree there's a causal connection between the dust and respiratory illnesses, attorney Warby says thousands of people have also contracted many other diseases, like cancer and kidney disease.
So you've got a list of carcinogens, you got a list of toxins, you got a list of diseases that my people have. You have the 50,000 people who weren't there, the 50,000 people who weren't there. You stack them all up, and the catastrophic response, scientifically, is that, oh my God, thousands and thousands and thousands of people are going to be significantly ill, and more people will die post 9/11 from these illnesses than died on 9/11.
Dr. Landrigan says it'll take a long-term commitment to study and treat all of the victims of the World Trade Center attack who might have other symptoms.
I think our responsibility as doctors who are caring for these people is to continue to examine them conscientiously, to continue to publish our reports every couple of years as new data become available, and continuously to sift the evidence and see what the connections are.
But who's going to pay for that long-term treatment and the studies? This fall, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg announced the establishment of the World Trade Center Environmental Health Center at Bellevue Hospital, an additional program building on several other city health monitoring efforts. And he renewed his call for long-term funding from state and federal authorities for treatment programs. This month, the federal government distributed an additional $40 million to various treatment centers. But Werby and other attorneys have also sued the city on behalf of rescue workers, saying it owes direct compensation to those who have fallen ill, like Richard Volpe.
You know, when I signed on the dotted line to be a New York City police officer, I knew that there's a possibility that I could get killed in the line of duty. I'm not here upset or angry that I'm sick, you know, because I could just as easily got shot or got into a car accident and died. I mean, when I signed on the line, I knew that chance was there. The only thing I would say is I'm disappointed. I'm disappointed that the fact that they made us out to be these heroes, which I don't consider myself a hero, I just consider a person that did his job. But they say what heroes we are, and now that we're sick, everybody's turned their back on us.
Initially, the city argued that it was immune from liability while they were providing services during an attack on U.S. soil. After all, the city didn't destroy the World Trade Center, terrorists did. Warby argued that the city was liable because it failed to protect workers after the emergency was over.
There's always been an emergency doctrine. You know, if the cop's chasing a robber and he bumps into a pedestrian and knocks him over, we give the cop the benefit of that. He was chasing a robber. That's an emergency. When the cop catches the robber and has him in the handcuffs, there's no need for him to be running and knocking anyone over anymore. The emergency is over. And although the motion was thousands of pages long and 40 hours, the 60 seconds of my argument was, you know, Your Honor, no planes hit the buildings on September 12th. No one else flew into our airspace. No war was declared. No one else fired a gun. No one else jumped off a building. Nothing else happened. The emergency was on 9/11. And that's when the immunity was for whatever we tried to do to save lives.
In October, a federal judge dismissed the city's immunity claim, and the trial will move forward, although no date has been set.
You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. My name's James. It's December 15th, 2006. It's our sixth episode, and we're into hour two. Just want to remind you, you can go to mediamonarchy.blogspot.com for all the news and videos and clips and media and everything you hear on this show. And the show is brought to you by the Portland Radio Authority. You can go to praradio.com for their podcasts and streams. You can go to my page or also radioforall.net for podcasts of the previous episodes of Media Monarchy. And you can even just send me an email, mediamonarchy@yahoo.com. Moving on, we're going to hit one of the biggest stories of the last week, and that's the death of the dictator Augusto Pinochet. And so my preface to this is what I wrote in the posting, just in case you've forgotten, dead dictator Pinochet was installed by the CIA as part of Operation Condor on one of our many other September 11th events. Documents reveal U.S. funding for Chile coup. And this is coming from the archives. I dug deep for this one. November 13th, 2000, from CNN. U.S. officials released documents on Monday acknowledging the CIA had provided covert aid 30 years ago to undermine Chile's government, but analysts say some of the most important documents have not yet been made public. The documents that would be revealing are still missing and still need to be declassified, Peter Kornbluh, Chile Documentation Project Director at the National Security Archive. The National Security Archive is a nonprofit organization that has campaigned for the release of the documents. One document, Kornbluh said, indicates that in 1991 the CIA destroyed a file on Manuel Contreras, the former head of Chile's secret police, now serving a sentence for the 1976 car bombing in Washington that killed Orlando Letelier, a prominent Chilean opposition leader. Letelier's American assistant, Ronnie Moffitt, also died in the blast. Now here's my own aside. Did you know that a car bomb went off in downtown Washington, D.C. in 1976? Never really hear much about that. CIA officials have said the file would not have information useful to U.S. Justice Department investigators who are trying to determine whether General Augusto Pinochet, who toppled Chile's president and then ruled the country for 17 years, also should be indicted for Letelier's murder. One of the key questions raised by this document is why that file was destroyed and what was in it that was destroyed, Kornbluh said. We cannot have a full record until all the documents are released. Kornbluh said. CIA officials, meanwhile, said only a few documents were not released. U.S. officials released 16,000 government documents, including a CIA memorandum indicating $1 million in covert aid had been given to Chilean opposition parties in an effort to undermine then-Chilean President Salvador Allende's socialist government. The United States previously released 7,000 records regarding its involvement leading up to the September 11, 1973 coup led by Pinochet that toppled Allende and killed him. Many of the documents, however, have been blacked out to protect sensitive information. U.S. President Bill Clinton had ordered in February 99 that the documents be made public. Today, we are closer than we've ever been able to absolute truth of this incident, Tom Blanton, National Security Archive Executive Director, told CNN. White House officials said the documents were released to allow the public to determine for itself whether U.S. actions had undermined democracy and human rights in Chile. Actions approved by the U.S. government during this period aggravated political polarization and affected Chile's long tradition of democratic elections and respect for the constitutional order and the rule of law, the White House said in a statement. Among the information contained in the documents released, the CIA provided secret funding to Chilean opposition parties in the early 1970s to try and undermine Allende's government. The funding had been approved by U.S. officials just 3 weeks before Allende was toppled by Pinochet. The Christian Democratic Party, now Chile's largest party, and the Radical Party of the Left had received money from the CIA. U.S. officials blacked out the names of other recipients. And the CIA had given Christian Democratic candidates funding as early as 1964. Kornbluh told CNN that the CIA, which provided $350,000 to help fund the coup, had not played a direct role in the coup. CIA officials had previously said the agency had not instigated the coup, but had been aware of military plotting to overthrow Allende. However, a Senate committee chaired by Senator Frank Church, Democrat from Idaho, had confirmed that the CIA had participated in covert operations in Chile and that the agency had attempted to foment a military coup in 1970 after Allende had been elected president. It's important to view these events in their proper historical context, CIA spokesman Mark Mansfield said. CIA activities were conducted within the framework of what U.S. policy was at the time, and covert actions were undertaken at the direction of the White House and interagency policy coordination committees. Researchers hoped the documents would provide details of a possible U.S. government role in toppling Allende's democratically elected government and in support of Pinochet. It may be of interest that in 1964, CIA conducted a deleted election operation in Chile, deleted, which contributed to the election of Eduardo Frei to the presidency, said a memo written before March 1969 elections. Allende was Frei's main opponent in that election. Frei died in 1982. His son, also named Eduardo Frei, is Chile's immediate past president. Last year, Clinton ordered U.S. government departments and agencies to find documents to highlight human rights abuses, terrorism, and political violence in Chile before and after the coup. The order is given after Pinochet was arrested in London, pending an extradition request by a Spanish judge who sought to put the former Chilean leader on trial for rights violations. Pinochet was released due to poor health nearly 500 days later. He was returned to Chile, where he faces trial for abuses that prosecutors allege he committed during his years in power. Prosecutors have said 3,000 people either were killed or disappeared under Pinochet's administration. With these documents, history of U.S. intervention in Chile and our support for the Pinochet regime can begin to be rewritten, Kornbluh said. And that's coming from the archives of CNN going back to November 13th, 2000. And of course now, with the death of dictator Pinochet, he of course escapes justice.
It's 25 years since General Pinochet took power in Chile. His terrible rule is still deeply remembered for the thousands of innocent lives he took. All over Chile, the ghosts still remain of Pinochet's concentration camps. Students, unionists, communists, lawyers, doctors. Every politically aware young Chilean was at risk of being detained. Many never came out alive.
My father opened the door. It was the police. They asked my name, and I was immediately taken into a bus. There were big flashlights in front of my house, military as well, in a jeep with machine guns pointing at me.
In 1973, General Pinochet, backed by America, staged a military coup and took power from the democratically elected government of President Allende. In the years that followed, Pinochet's regime was responsible for the killing and disappearance of more than 3,000 students, professionals, and activists. Today, Chile's army would rather forget the nasty truth of their history during Pinochet's years. It was the height of the Cold War. Pinochet was pro-West, and the US didn't like the Allende government's left-wing politics. Without America's support, Pinochet could not have mounted his coup. Today, he's accused of devising the worst concentration camp regime since Hitler's grand plan. Pinochet rounded up everyone his forces deemed the remotest risk to his new military junta. He threw them into places like this, the Chacabuco Desert Camp. By the end of 1973, 250,000 Chileans had been detained in remote and godforsaken prisons. Were you a member of a party? The Socialist Workers' Party, USOPO. Were you politically active in any party? No, I was an independent on the left. And now you're here as a prisoner? I'm detained as long as they're making the inquiries. You're a doctor? Yes. Were you active with a party? No. Are there many sick here? Most serious are neuroses and mental disorders. How do they manifest themselves? Insomnia, agitation, and trembling. What brings it on? The circumstances we're in, and the uncertainty of our trials.
When we arrived there, it was quite shocking to see the guards all surrounding the camp, because you see that sort of concentration camp in films. You never think you're going to be one of them.
Para esto he venido al mundo, a dar el testimonio.
These unique images were taken by the only team of journalists to gain access to the camps. A European film crew had persuaded the Chilean authorities to allow them entrance. Their permit stated they were not to visit the detainees. But they talked their way in. It was an extraordinary piece of journalistic footwork. Some prisoners are dangerous. So although no charges have been brought against them, they must stay there until they realize that they're on the wrong path. Inside Chacabuco concentration camp, the film crew from Europe soon discovered what the right path meant. The first group of prisoners with whom we were authorized to make contact. We haven't yet begun to record any sound, when suddenly the scene changes. At first we took them for soldiers training. Then we found out that they were special category prisoners. The marching men are exclusively young communists. They're forced to sing military songs. Our camera is not supposed to see them. They're ordered to withdraw.
Lograremos fotografiarlos secretamente, pero hablar con ellos nos está definitivamente prohibido.
I saw them pass with their cameras in and out, but I never wanted to show my face because you never knew what they could do with your pictures. Of if they show the pictures to some of the prisoners and where else, they may recognize you. And you would be in trouble. So everybody was sort of suspicious and didn't want to show themselves. Unless there were people who everybody knew.
Were you a politically active militant? Yes. With which party? Communist? Are you awaiting trial? I don't know what trial can be called. I was at work when I was taken to the National Stadium, and now I'm here.
Había indicación expresa, nada de torres.
We've given explicit orders. Film no watchtowers, no barbed wire, no military guards. The commander of the camp did not allow us out of his sight. We went around the camp following a prescribed route. And the film crew went on, deeper, into Chile's most inhospitable zones, to find the most notorious camps. They were looking for a prison where they'd heard women were being kept. Its name was Pisagua.
Señorita,
when did you arrive here? 22nd of December. Are you politically active? No. How long do you think you'll be here? I haven't got a clue.
When the film crew left, we went back to the darkness and the horror of living under threat, continuous threat that anything could happen to us. Everything was prepared in a way to look normal.
Thousands of survivors from Pinochet's prison camps exiled themselves to safer parts of the world, like Stirling in Scotland. Patricia Letelier was imprisoned and tortured in the concentration camps. She spent 5 months there.
I started hearing the shouting and the screaming, really, of the men that were in another room. I went really cold and I was terrified. I didn't know. I knew what was waiting for me. So I was, shortly after I was moved to that other space, and there my torture started.
Today, Patricia lives with her partner, Oliver, and their son. 25 years on, she still suffers side effects from the torture she experienced during those dark, distant days.
Thank you.
Leonora Alvarez Reyes.
I'm Leonora Alvarez Reyes. Were you politically active? Never. When did you arrive? 23rd of November. How long will you be here? Until the commandant decides. I'm Iris Campos. How long have you been here? Almost 2 months. Are you politically active? I'm a sympathizer. When do you think you'll get out of Pisagua? I haven't got a clue.
After they tie my hand behind my back, they hung me from my wrist. I sat down. And I have this bag over my head. My clothes were taken off. And they put water over me. And the more that I was shivering because of the shock, the harder it was to beat him.
Please get out.
What's your name? Patricia Pizarro Letelier. When did you come? 15th of November, 1973. Are you a member of a party? No, the only organization I was a member of was a left-wing student organization. Witnesses who were able to flee Chile have said that the guards abused them while they were prisoners.
Pisagua, 1974.
25 years later, Patricia's new life is very different. She's now comfortable and secure. Through the local Sterling Chile support group, Patricia, like thousands of other Chilean exiles scattered around the world, dreams about bringing Pinochet to trial.
He has been hiding behind this amnesty. And nobody has said that he gave himself this amnesty. Nobody gave it to him. He gave himself this amnesty as a condition to step down from power, so he knew that he was guilty. And that is what we have to emphasize. The man is guilty.
Caught up in the paranoia of the Cold War and encouraged by the USA, Pinochet had become obsessed with obliterating Marxism. I do not say we have totally triumphed over Marxism. Marxism is like a ghost. It's very difficult to catch, impossible to trap. Mass graves have been discovered around Chile's prison camps. The real business of killing and torture usually took place elsewhere. The Santiago Sports Stadium was chosen by the authorities for its holding capacity. 10 days after Pinochet's coup, it held 7,000 prisoners. The photographs were taken from a hidden place, an apartment in a high building overlooking the National Stadium. We had a powerful telephoto lens. In this way, it was possible to secretly obtain the graphic evidence of what the world knows already from eyewitness statements.
We didn't know where we were going because they said they were going to kill us. So eventually, trying to look up through the near side of the lorry, we realized we were getting to a stadium. So at least we knew we were going to be with more people, so people would see us. But also we were afraid because everybody knew that in the stadium were killing people. The minute you get your clothes off, and everybody went naked inside, yeah, with a cover, your head. I start to sweat underneath. They hang me and they put electricity and all that all over my body. I was naked. And they interviewed, what they call interview. They interviewed me for, I would say, 10 to 12 hours. I saw a pile of people lying there and a pool of blood coming out of this pile of people.
Es una guerra de inteligencia.
This is a war of intelligence,
en la cual
which we're treating as when one wants to have a good shave.
Es la posición
we want to allow them to grow so that later on we can shave them smoothly and leave nothing behind.
Para después afeitar suavemente y no dejar nada.
Pinochet had called a war, though there was no reason. He'd wrenched the heart from a young and vibrant country.
We were prisoners of war of Pinochet because it was a convenient term. We never had a war in Chile. It was not a civil war. It was Pinochet declared war to the Chilean people because they want to change the political system or because they want a different way of life. That's all.
In the late 1980s, Pinochet was finally forced out of office and his concentration camps discarded. Recently, Patricia Letelier took her family back to the Pisagua prison most people would think she'd never want to see again.
We are inside the building now, where the women's jail, and a part of this hole here, piece of wood missing, the place look like exactly as the time when we were kept. We live in that building for 5 months with no light and just one window where we could have fresh air.
Within hundreds of meters of recently discovered mass graves, Pinochet has built himself a holiday villa. When Patricia visited there recently, she was told he still liked to be there.
As far as I remember, we were told when we were in Pisagua that Augusto Pinochet had been visiting the place a few weeks earlier. That's one of the things that kept me alive, really. I have to go back and I have to tell the world what happened there.
Thank you, sir.
¿Dónde son desanido? Todavía cantamos, todavía pedimos, todavía soñamos, todavía esperamos.
25 years after Pinochet devised his evil system, the people who suffered still hope for justice. Pinochet may yet pay for the souls he so easily took.
Proof of concentration camps and torture under Pinochet's regime, and that was called Chile, the Crimes of Pinochet. And it's coming from Journeyman TV, and you can get it on Google Video. You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. My name is James. It's December 15th. It's our sixth episode. And our next story, top-level insiders selling their stock. This is coming from the New York Post. America's corporate chiefs are unloading their own stocks at one of the boldest paces in 20 years. In cases of the very rich, such as Microsoft's Bill Gates and Google's top brass, the executives are selling a whopping 63 for each dollar of stock they bought, says a report by Bloomberg. In November alone, leaders of companies dumped $8.4 billion worth of stock they owned as insiders, most of it awarded as compensation, bonuses, or other management incentives. but the vast majority of the executives put their windfall cash to work elsewhere, with just $133 million being plowed back into purchases of more company stock. Analysts say a take-the-money-and-run flight from their own companies signals a growing lack of confidence in the economy's future course, as well as fears of a possible global meltdown if the Iraq crisis escalates across borders. It's also a good time to take profits, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average up nearly 15% this year, the S&P 500 ahead 13%, and the NASDAQ 11% higher. Wall Street investors are displaying fresh worries that the Federal Reserve might pull the trigger too quickly on hiking rates again, possibly plunging the U.S. into a recession as the Fed did in 2000. Just before the worst of the 2000 recession, insider sales were also at near record. Leading the latest wave of insider selling is Microsoft, with $594.2 million of stock sold by insiders during November, with Gates unloading $581.1 million. Gates has been selling shares regularly, including $2.1 billion last year, as he whittles down his once mammoth stake, putting a big chunk of his wealth to work in a not-for-profit foundation that invests in a wide range of securities and other deals, like vaccines for the children. Billionaire Paul Allen also sold off 28% of his stake last month in DreamWorks Animation SKG for $224.2 million, keeping about $21 million in shares. Insiders at Seagate sold $311 million in November, while Google insiders unloaded $182 million in the 4 weeks. Google CEO Eric Schmidt and its co-founders Sergey Brin and Larry Page have usually led the insider selling parade, with sales of hundreds of millions as the stock rose steadily to break the $500 mark. Next on MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com is a long interview with ex-MI5 agent David Shaler on good old Rupert Murdoch's Sky News over in the UK. You can get the video on MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com, and that's thanks to CremationOfCare.com. I'm not going to play that entire video. It's about a half hour, but if you are interested in David Shaler exposing the Litvinenko murder, 9/11, 7/7, and a whole lot of other gruesome stuff, go to MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com. The next story, impeachment rallies held coast to coast. I initially heard the word from Portland Indie Media, impeachment protest for Human Rights Day at Pioneer Square, and World Can't Wait Portland was also holding an impeachment protest on National Human Rights Day. The focus was on legalization of torture, the Military Commissions Act, and impeachment. And from Raw Story, it says this Sunday, Human Rights Day has been renamed Human Rights and Impeachment Day as groups hold rallies from coast to coast across the United States calling for President Bush and Vice President Cheney to be impeached. The purpose of these events is to organize people to lobby their Congress members for investigations and impeachment, and to lobby their local and state governments for resolutions in support of impeachment. Democrats.com co-founder Bob Furtick writes, the rallies were kicked off at a New York City forum which featured former Representative Elizabeth Holtzman and anti-war peace mom Cindy Sheehan, who I believe was arrested for trespassing. As her final legislative act on last Friday, outgoing Georgia Representative Cynthia McKinney introduced an impeachment bill, although it was just a, quote, symbolic parting shot by the controversial Democrat and has no chance of passing. According to AfterDowningStreet.org, one of the activist groups hoping to organize this weekend's events, there will now also be rallies to honor and thank Cynthia McKinney. Events scheduled included rallies and parades held in such cities as Seattle, Madison, Chicago, Detroit, and Tallahassee. At a beach in San Francisco, human bodies will be used to spell out the word impeach. Also in San Francisco, under the spot where the UN signed its charter 60 years ago, activists will sing carols while clad in orange jumpsuits similar to the ones that detainees at Guantanamo Bay are forced to wear. Now, I have to say, it was a sad showing of people here in Portland at Pioneer Square. I'd worked graveyard shift all night, came home, found out about the news, turned around, came back downtown, and found 10 people at Pioneer Square for the protest. So, not exactly a fantastic turnout, but I made 10 friends and felt like I did something. Next story, Judge Wade's torture claim versus Rumsfeld. This is coming from the Ventura County State. federal judge last Friday appeared reluctant to give Donald Rumsfeld immunity from torture allegations, yet said it would be unprecedented to let the departing defense secretary face a civil trial. "What you're asking for has never been done before," U.S. District Judge Thomas F. Hogan told lawyers for the American Civil Liberties Union. The group is suing on behalf of 9 former prisoners in Iraq and Afghanistan. The lawsuit contends the men were beaten, suspended upside down from the ceiling by chains, urinated on, shocked, sexually humiliated, burned, locked inside boxes, and subjected to mock executions. If the suit were to go forward, it could force Rumsfeld and the Pentagon to disclose what officials knew about abuses at prisons such as Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, and what was done to stop it. Our next story, cancer scientists funded by Monsanto. Coming from The Guardian, a world-famous British scientist failed to disclose that he held a paid consultancy with a chemical company for more than 20 years while investigating cancer risks in the industry, The Guardian can reveal. Sir Richard Doll, D-O-L-L, the celebrated epidemiologist who established that smoking causes lung cancer, was receiving a consultancy fee of $1,500 a day in the mid-80s from Monsanto, then a major chemical company and now better known for its GM crop business. While he was being paid by Monsanto, Sir Richard wrote to a Royal Australian Commission investigating the potential cancer-causing properties of Agent Orange, made by Monsanto and used by the U.S. in Vietnam War. Sir Richard said there was no evidence that the chemical caused cancer. Our next story, Wesley Snipes pleads not guilty in tax case. This is coming from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Wesley Snipes was released on $1 million bond after pleading not guilty to federal charges, including falsely claiming millions of dollars in tax refunds 2 months after he was indicted in Central Florida. The actor, known for films such as The Blade Trilogy, didn't speak at a court appearance in Ocala on Friday. He went there after arriving in Orlando on a private jet from the African nation of Namibia, where he was filming Gallo Walker, his publicist said. "I look forward to clearing my name and resolving this issue post-haste," Snipes, wearing blue tinted glasses and suit, said after the hearing. He didn't comment further. Snipes, 44, was charged in October with fraudulently claiming refunds totaling nearly $12 million in 96 and 97 on income taxes already paid. He was also charged with failure to file returns from 99 to 2004. If convicted, he faces up to 16 years in prison. He will be allowed to return to Namibia to finish the film, but must return to his home in Marina Del Rey, California by January 10th, U.S. Magistrate Gary Jones ruled. After that, he will be required to surrender his U.S. passport and will be restricted to traveling in the continental United States. A February 22nd status conference was scheduled, which Snipes isn't required to attend. According to the indictment, Snipes had his taxes prepared by accountants with a history of filing false returns to reap payments for their clients. The firm, American Rights Litigators, would receive 20% of refunds from clients, according to the indictment. "We believe the evidence in the case will show that he has been the victim of unscrupulous tax advice, and this trial will help vindicate him," said Billy Martin, Snipes' lawyer. Gallo Walker, a cowboy movie, will be completed next week and will be released sometime next fall, said Ian Thompson, spokesman for Shear Films, which is producing the movie. Snipes' arrest wasn't expected to delay production, Thompson said. Martin said Snipes left the United States to film the movie long before the indictment. "We want to make it clear that he did not avoid returning to the United States. He's always been ready to return," Martin said. You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. My name's James. You can go to mediamonarchy.blogspot.com for this and all the news and videos and media and things we cover on this show every Friday at 10 on the Portland Radio Authority. You can go to praradio.com for the streams and schedules. Send me an email at mediamonarchy@yahoo.com. And thankfully now, podcasts are available thanks to radioforall.net. Now, fortunately, I'm going to be able to get to some of the things I had missed and wanted to get to in previous weeks. We're going to jump to a video featuring John Stockwell, and this one's called America's Third World War.
My expertise, as you know, is CIA, Marine Corps, three CIA secret wars. I had a position in the National Security Council in 1975 as the chief of the Angola task force running the secret war in Angola. It was the third CIA secret war I was part of. The national security law creating the National Security Council and the CIA, as you know, was passed in 1947. The CIA was given this charter to perform such other duties and function as might be necessary to the national security interest, and given a vague authority to protect its sources and methods. I think it was in the mid-80s that I coined this phrase, the Third World War, because in my research I realized that we were not attacking the Soviet Union and the CIA's activities. We were attacking people in the Third World. And I'm going to just quickly, in the interest of time, just give you a little sense of what that means, this Third World War. Basically, it's the third, I believe, in terms of loss of life and human destruction, the third bloodiest war in all of history. They undertake to run operations in every corner of the globe. They also undertook the license of operating just totally above and beyond U.S. laws. They had a license, if you will, to kill, but also they took that to a license to smuggle drugs, a license to do all kinds of things to other people and other societies in violation of international law, our law, and every principle of nations working together for a healthier and more peaceful world. Meanwhile, again, they battled to convert the U.S. legal system in such a way that it would give them control of our society. Now, we have massive documentation of what they call the secret wars of the CIA. We don't have to guess or speculate. We had the Church Committee investigate them in 1975, gave us our first really in-depth, powerful look inside this structure. Senator Church said in the 14 years before he did his investigation that he found they had run 900 major operations and 3,000 minor operations. And if you extrapolate that over the whole period of the 40-odd years that we've had a CIA, you come up with 3,000 major operations and over 10,000 minor operations. Every one of them illegal, every one of them disruptive of the lives and societies of other people, and many of them bloody and gory, beyond comprehension almost. Extensively, we manipulated and organized the overthrow of functioning constitutional democracies in other countries. We organized secret armies and directed them to fight in just about every continent in the world. We encouraged ethnic minorities to rise up and fight. People like the Mosquito Indians in Nicaragua, the Kurds in the Middle East, the Hmongs in Southeast Asia. And of course, we have organized and we still do and fund death squads in countries around the world, like the Treasury Police in El Salvador, which are responsible for most of the killing of the 50,000 people just in the 80s, and there were 70,000 before that. And orchestration, CIA secret teams, and propaganda led us directly into the Korean War. We were attacking China from the islands, Kaimoi, Matsu, Thailand, Tibet. A lot of drug trafficking involved in this, by the way. Until eventually we convinced ourselves to fight the Chinese in Korea. And we had the Korean War, and 1 million people were killed. Same thing for the Vietnam War, and we have extensive documentation of how the CIA was involved at every level of the national security complex, because it's a very cooperative thing, into manipulating the nation into the Vietnam War. And we wound up creating the Golden Triangle, in which the CIA, Air America airplanes, were flying in arms to our allies and flying back out with the heroin. We launched the largest, this is something that Jimmy Carter did, Admiral Turner brags about it, the operation in Afghanistan. Biggest single operation, I'm told, in the history of the CIA's secret wars. And sure enough, very quickly we produced the Golden Crescent, which is still the largest source of heroin perhaps in the world today. I'm trying to summarize this Third World War that the CIA, the U.S. National Security Complex, with the military all interwoven in it in many different ways, has been waging. Let me just put it this way. The best heads that I coordinate with studying this thing, we count at least minimum figure 6 million people who've been killed in this long 40-year war that we've waged against the people of the Third World. These are not Soviets. We have not been parachuting teams into the Soviet Union to kill and hurt and maim people, especially not since 1954 when they developed actually a capability of dropping atomic weapons on the United States. They aren't British, French, Swedes, Swiss, Belgians. We don't do bloody, gory operations in the countries of Europe. These are all people of the Third World. They're people of countries like the Congo, Vietnam, Kampuchea, Indonesia, Nicaragua, where conspicuously they nor their governments do not have the capability of doing any physical hurt to the United States. They don't have ICBMs. They don't have armies or navies. They could not hurt us if they wanted to. There has rarely been any evidence that they really wanted to. And that, in fact, is perhaps the whole point. If they had had ICBMs, we probably wouldn't have done the things to them for fear of retaliation. Cheap shots, if you will, killing people of other countries of the world who cannot defend themselves under the guise of secrecy and under the rubric of national security.
Prison. We must wage what I have called total war against public enemy number one in the United States, the problem of dangerous drugs.
80% of the cops shot in this area were shot because people are high on drugs. So we want to give drugs to everybody. Let them all shoot the cops.
I fell asleep at the wheel pulling out of my parking lot of my house. And I woke up to the police being there. And underneath the seat of my car was 11 cents worth of methamphetamine.
We're not going to legalize drugs. We're not going to do it.
There's a new epidemic. Smokable cocaine, otherwise known as crack.
Crack, 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 cocaine epidemic.
Okay, Kevin, you're going to hit it.
Hit it, dig it off.
Cooking was always our most vulnerable and our most time-consuming thing to do. Usually you could put it in like a big Samsonite suitcase. You could put 100 keys just about in one of those, or maybe two of them. So that's what we normally cook every night, like 100 kilos.
I had lost two family members and a best friend in a very short span of time to alcohol, cigarettes, and legal prescription drugs. So feeling depressed and a little angry, I decided that the next victim of the drug war was not going to be me.
Don't touch that or it's electric, you'll die.
Oh, okay.
We don't screw around here. This isn't Texas.
Now, we all know that the U.S. government and the CIA supported the Contras in their efforts to overthrow the Sandinista government in Nicaragua in the middle 80s. Now, it is alleged the CIA also helped the Contras raise money for arms by introducing crack cocaine into California.
I already knew that from the beginning of dealing with Danilo Blandón that he was sending supplies and things of that nature, computers and guns, to Nicaragua to fight a war.
Will you pursue Ali North and George Bush and the massive documentation? All these gentlemen, like this gentleman here, the co-defendant of Ricky Ross.
The question should have been asked about all that cocaine flying back over here.
The CIA is an agency. It is a strong pillar of our democracy.
I am a former Los Angeles police narcotics detective, and I work South Central Los Angeles, and I will tell you, Director Deutsch, that the agency has dealt drugs throughout this country for a long time.
The truth was that the drug trade was a protected commercial enterprise on behalf of Wall Street, policed, run, and managed by the Central Intelligence Agency.
Well,
weed every day.
Now, this is my first time eating good, so are you supposed to inhale?
Almost everyone I know, including myself, has tried smoking marijuana at least once. So why does our government classify marijuana right alongside of drugs like crack and crystal meth when its effects are obviously so different?
The people in Washington realize that 85% of all people in the United States of America today that use any form of illicit drug use only marijuana. That means that the total numbers of everybody else that uses any other drug would not justify this colossal prison industrial complex, this colossal bureaucracy that we have to fight the war on drugs.
We are not going to arrest basically the backbone, the fabric of America today.
You go to children and you say, do you remember your mom, dad, coach, teacher saying marijuana is unacceptable? If I remember hearing that, I'm not using drugs.
So, how's tobacco?
Hello, NBC.
What lesson
did the world take from San Francisco?
What place? What's wrong with Tent City?
Well, no,
it's great.
I was saying
yeah, the message is you do the crime, you're going to do the time, and it's not going to be nice. Very simple. Very simple. And I'll tell you another thing, these convicted people should be punished. They should be punished, and I hope that they're being punished on 12-cent meals.
This is just nothing about drugs. This is considered a neutral territory to gangs.
Dude, if these people knew what we were doing, we'd be fucking dead.
You know, we had houses where you basically would go up to the window and it would be served right out the window, kind of like the way McDonald's does it, I guess. Because we had houses in so many different locations. Basically, you know, I wanted a location. I wanted it to be convenient for the people, you know, where they wouldn't have to drive for.
We're going to go ahead and pick you up, and we're going to put you on our gurney, okay?
Okay, we're going to say journey. So journey's Jesus, easy.
All right.
Watch the please me clean up my mama's horse.
So I'm going to lift you up and put you on my gurney, all right? Just chill out.
Journey's with God or devil's with Jesus. As your mama said, Diddy's got to squeeze theyself.
Now, I don't understand why the government didn't use Freeway Rick the way they used him. Set him up to go buy this from the big man and bust the big man. They know he ain't the big man. He's somebody who's bringing it to him.
Yeah, nobody's
so
the
why
big
they
man.
Didn't reverse it?
They always
it
take you almost to
make it seem like he's
yeah,
the man.
They never
but somebody is bringing it to him.
Who is the real drug lord?
Our problem isn't that we use too many drugs. Our problem is we've got too much money.
I'm afraid of America. I'm afraid of the world. I'm afraid I can't help it. I'm afraid I can't. I'm afraid of America.
What's it come down, Mike? I don't know. I never came down.
I'm afraid I can't. I'm afraid I can't. Yeah, I'm afraid of America.
Heroin makes you nod and get in traffic accidents. Marijuana makes you sit on your couch and speed puts you in the fast lane.
That's your opinion.
I'm afraid of Americans.
God is an American.
What is this, a documentary on drugs?
We keep hearing that somehow our federal government is connected to the drug trade. That the Contra-Iran scandal was just a cover-up for a Contra-cocaine scandal. And we're also hearing that somehow the vice president, with his CIA connections, was very, very knowledgeably and purposely involved in that Contra-cocaine scandal. Senator Kerry is slowly bringing that material out into the public so that people are hearing that there was most likely that connection. And one of the things that I think you can do is to clean house in the government from top to bottom and get rid of these elected administration cocaine pushers and to stop Bush from getting in there, because if he gets in there, a lot of those same things that are touching every one of us in this city and every city is just going to keep on happening, and we need a man like you.
That was a clip from a Robert Altman HBO series from 1988 called Tanner 88. I wanted to cut out and play that clip for you. He's speaking to community leaders in Detroit, and they bring up the fact that the CIA runs drugs. And the clip you heard before that was an extended trailer for a documentary coming out by Kevin Booth and Sacred Cow Productions. And that's called The Last White Hope, and started that off with John Stockwell and America's Third World War. And those are things I wanted to get to in the last couple of weeks, but wasn't able to do it. Fortunately, had some time and hit it. You've been listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. My name's James, here with you every Friday morning at 10 a.m., 1 p.m. Eastern. Go to mediamonarchy.blogspot.com for all the news and videos and clips and links and stories and PDFs and information that you hear on this show. I want to thank the Portland Radio Authority for letting me do this. I want to thank you for listening. If you enjoy the show, I implore you to go to the page and get the podcast thanks to radioforall.net. That's radio, the letter, not the letter. Radio, the numeral, for all.net. And there's 5 episodes, and this is the 6th. Bookmark the page. It's updated every day. And tune in here every Friday. You can also send me an email at mediamonarchy@yahoo.com. This was a good episode. I think some of the things to think about that we went over is the immigration and the coming crisis. I think we're being set up for some kind of basically race war, and it's the same old divide and conquer. So keep your eye and ear peeled on that. Guest worker program and amnesty is watchwords you're going to be hearing coming up. Going on right now, the Holocaust Convention. God knows what's going on with that. And all the other things we touched on. Toxic dust from the World Trade Center towers. Gordon Smith pissed off about the Iraq War. This is Media Monarchy, Portland Radio Authority. Thanks for listening. Take care.
Police would get him just the same.